All right. All right, members. The chair calls the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. We are at quorum. Members, we've got a few items we want to do today. One is adopt a series of minutes, and I believe Chair Dean might have a motion for us to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the approval of minutes from February 5th. And if you don't mind, move them for February 6th as well. However, I will make a note that House File 591, I believe, was amended before it was laid over for possible inclusion. So if we could just make that addition on February 6th, that you laid over House File 591 as amended for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Very well. Thank you, Chairman Dean. So the motion is before us to adopt the minutes of February 5th and February 6th as amended by indicating that House File 591 was recommended to be laid over at that meeting. Members, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Dean. All right, so members, today we have two bills. I thought we had three. There's the other side of the paper. Yes, we have three bills, two by the chair and one by Chairman Lesch. But before we do that, we're going to hear a presentation on decriminalizing communities. And members, this will be pertinent to House File 739, which I'll that I am carrying, and then I'll be presenting along with a number of testifiers this morning. Members, upcoming testimony, as well as the House File 739, is relevant to the committee's focus on community-centered public safety. We've had, regardless of the snow, we've had a pretty good week this week, I think, in terms of emphasizing that particular point and value, beginning with the testimony on Tuesday of Director Todd Miller of the great city of Mankato, Representative Considine, who also came to us by way of a number of cities in Minnesota, as well as national and international background, to share an element of community-centered public safety in regards to community policing. And of course, yesterday we heard from Representative Edelson's bill, really focusing on one component of community-centered public safety, which had to do with factoring our sentencing guidance in law to incorporate the well-being of children as a way to make sure that we're not doing harm to the sense of community and to family life in Minnesota. And so today, House File 739, which I'll be carrying, seeks to extend that concept in regards to individuals who will be petitioning the court relative to decisions that may impact their immigration status. And so with that, members, I'm going to call forward, it looks like three individuals, and perhaps they can all come forward together. We just so happen to have three comfortable chairs right at the testifiers' table. John Gordon of the ACLU, Anika Bowie, I hope I said that right, founder of Restore the Vault, and John Sray, Jenny Sray, co-director of Release Minnesota 8. And the chair would be glad to be corrected on any mispronunciations of your names. And right now I've got Mr. Gordon first, but you all decide who should do that. And I believe you're Mr. Gordon, sir?
Chair Mariani, yes. Chair Mariani, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm John Gordon, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. Thanks for allowing me to spend a few minutes with you today to give you our perspective on decriminalizing communities. I propose to make three points in 3 minutes. One, Overextending the reach of law enforcement unnecessarily makes all of us, less safe, but especially those of us who are black or brown or native or poor or recent immigrants. Number two, the operation of the policing and criminal justice systems magnifies the immigration limitations of systems of our federal government and its so-called zero-tolerance policies. Number three, over-criminalizing our society is a civil liberties issue that is or should be nonpartisan, with supporters from all over the political spectrum. So first, number one, over-aggressive law enforcement destroys the relationships between law enforcement and the communities they are supposed to be protecting. There is this notion around that if you are law-abiding, you have nothing to worry about and the police are your friends who protect you. That's just wrong. For one thing, as former Minnesotan Emily Baxter has titled a beautiful book of stories and photographs, "We Are All Criminals." We are all criminals. I have done things that are against the law, and I look around the room without looking at anybody in particular, and I'm going to say I believe every one of us has. But the criminal justice system lands very differently on some people than it does on others. I was in a hotel ballroom last week in which the speaker asked, "Who here feels safe calling 911? Vast swaths of the room sat on their hands. Another example, so-called crime-free housing ordinances like the one that we have challenged in the city of Faribault penalize people who call 911 seeking police help because they can be evicted from their apartments and their homes. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. 5% of the population and 25% of all the prisoners in the world. In Minnesota, since 1980, our prison population has increased by a factor of five times as many people as we had, mostly people of color. Our racial disparities in Minnesota are worse than almost anywhere else in the United States of America. Our black population is 5%. Our prison population is 30% black, 30 versus 5%. Native Americans, 1% of the population and 8% of the prison population. Number two, I want to talk about how the interaction between law enforcement and immigration enforcement. I represented a client whose father brought him to this country legally when he was two. He served 90 days in jail as a young adult and then ended up in jail for 440 days in immigration detention in a fruitless attempt to remove him to Cambodia, a country where he had never, ever set foot in his entire life. We represent another young woman who was rear-ended in a traffic accident, and instead of just being ticketed, she was arrested and hauled down to the police station where she was held intentionally long enough for ICE to come by and scoop her up and toss her into immigration detention. Sheriffs in this state hold people for longer than state law allows. They hold them for longer than state law allows, and they acknowledge that by relying on so-called ICE holds, which even ICE does not claim is a legitimate basis for holding people. So these systems, these law enforcement systems and the immigration systems in this country interact. Number three, finally, the cry for locking more people up comes from very few people. Folks all over the political spectrum see mass incarceration as a problem. If you do sophisticated legal research like I did and Google the term over-incarceration, what you find popping up significantly is very politically conservative websites. Look at the Federal First Step Act, supported by the ACLU and the White House. So we know that over-incarceration makes families less stable and it destroys communities. Making offenses out of vague and subjective offenses and arresting people for low-level crimes increases the number of police interactions and increases the odds of a bad result. And here I'll mention Philando Castile. I also would direct your attention to our Picking Up the Pieces study of Minneapolis enforcement of low-level offenses and the racial disparities that result. It's at aclu.org/Minneapolis. So for all these reasons and others that you are about to hear, we are deeply grateful for your attention to this topic. Chair Mariani and members, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. And please give us your name and your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Anika Bowie. I'm the Vice President of Minneapolis NAACP, as well as the lead organizer for Restore the Vote Minnesota Coalition. And most importantly, I am a voter. So I'm here to share my story as a voter and also to speak on behalf of those who are disenfranchised. I am a voter who recognizes there are over 50,000 Minnesotans who cannot legally cast their ballot like me and others on this committee. A title that my father, and his father could not call themselves because of our Constitution called them, labeled them slaves, non-landowners, non-white men, convicted felons, and now criminal. Laws written in the Jim Crow era of forced caste-like system of segregation. Michelle Alexander also authors the book, The New Jim Crow, The Times That We Are Living In. Minnesota has yet to overcome a history of second-class citizenship and legalized discrimination. Over 64% of disenfranchised voters live outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County. Laws that impact 70% of white Minnesotans, 24% of African Americans, 6% of Hispanic and Native Americans in Minnesota. Restore the Vote has over 50 organizations collaborating every day on pushing legislation, building grassroots movement, and educating our networks on how to restore disenfranchised voters. We work to make Minnesota a North Star state that guides our states to be less restrictive and more restorative. When a judge decides that a person is free to live within their community, our government should be in the business of allowing a person to fully integrate in all ways, all process that makes him, her, or them productive and welcomed. This person not only is integrating into a society, but integrating into a family, a school, a job, and a democracy. Issues of healthcare, education, and environment has all been prioritized by the House Speaker, Michelle Hortman. All of these issues are knocking on all of our doors, and we can pick up the phone as constituents and call our representatives. But 50,000 Minnesotans cannot answer that call until our legislators restore his, her, and their civil rights to vote. Restore the Vote Minnesota Coalition believes in a government that doesn't lock up communities and throw away the key. We believe we cannot solve our problems by criminalizing a community suffering from the backlash of Jim Crow laws. I want to say thank you for allowing us to be here to speak to the voices of those who have been criminalized, and that we push into passing legislation and voting on bills that decriminalize communities for historical generationals. Let's walk forward into a future to where we are humanizing those who have been marginalized. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie. We have a question from Representative Considine. No? Oh, I thought we did. All right. Representative Johnson.
I just have one question. You mentioned law enforcement overreach. I just trying to understand that.
I believe that's for you, Mr. Gordon.
I apologize. I could not hear the question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I was just wondering what you were considering and if you could explain what law enforcement overreach is.
Mr. Gordon.
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, the over-criminalization and over-policing of communities, in fact, does not make people safe. There are a number of offenses that are on the books that simply do not justify incarcerating people or even arresting them. There's been some progress made in communities by Minneapolis, for example, has repealed its lurking and spitting ordinances. But there are a number of other violations that are both low level and don't warrant incarceration, and leave an enormous amount of discretion in police that is sometimes exercised unfairly against communities of color. So in general, it is, in answer to your question, it is law enforcement over focusing on minor offenses that disrupt communities, destroy families, break up the communities that, in which they occur, without increasing public safety.
And Mr. Gordon, I think you applied the term law enforcement inclusively, but also very broadly in terms of, you know, a system of laws as well as the, at least that's what I'm hearing.
It is, Chair Mariani, it is a system. I heard some remarks the other day that remind us all that we should be hard on systems but soft on individuals. This is not an attack on any individuals at all, but this is a system that, as Ms. Bowie has pointed out, has grown up, has accreted over the years to the point where we end up where we are. It does not have anything to do with any particular individuals.
I appreciate that, Mr. Gordon. As I see the function of a state legislature, it is, in fact, to focus on systems. We've created them. We have the duty and the responsibility to review their effectiveness and whether they reflect the values that we hold in common, and then to adapt and adjust them if necessary. I know oftentimes members of this body on all sides of the political spectrum often get a little bit tripped up by focusing on individuals within our society. And obviously, we're going to talk about individuals, but our job here is to shape laws, which is by nature a function of shaping systems. So I appreciate that distinction. Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you please state your name again, ma'am?
Anika Bowie.
Anika, thank you for being here. And you mentioned something about restorative justice, or restore the vote, I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was visited by Restore the Vote. I don't know if you have direct connection with them or know how to connect with them. But
so actually, we're talking about the Restore the Vote Minnesota Coalition?
Yeah. So I got visited in my freshman. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's quite all right.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I got visited by several attorneys who were asking or wanted to talk about restore the vote, and I had a very good conversation with them. I asked them to come back, and let's continue the conversation. I haven't seen them since. I've got some ideas that I hope to share with them, but you know, I haven't heard from them since that first visit. We didn't see eye to eye on everything, but like everything else, working together, a person can find some common ground to work from.
Ms. Bowie.
Chair Mariani, thank you so much, Representative Grasso, I believe. I commend it absolutely. I think what you have done is extended an olive branch of collaboration and conversation about how we can push voter restoration bill forward. And I think we are here for you. We definitely, you know, this is lived experience that we want to see transform here with your power. I know as the organizer of the coalition, we have so many different organizations who are building the capacity to be consistent, as well as building capacity and resources to be here. We also understand that those who are impacted not only are criminalized, but you know, suffer economic justice to where they're not able to have the privilege to be here consistently to lobby on this issue, to advocate on this issue takes privilege and takes flexibility. And that's why, you know, me as a representative of this issue is willing to be here every single day.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie. Representative Ross.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So if you could, if you would be so kind, have them reach out to me, have your associates reach out to me, let's set up an appointment, and let's have some more conversation.
Chairman Marani, I also want to just stand corrected, too. In my remarks, I had mispronounced Melissa Hortman, House Speaker's name, and I just want to stand corrected on clarifying that Melissa Hortman is who I was referring to.
Ms. Bowie, we'll keep it all between us in the room. I don't want you to get in trouble with the speaker. So. And I would absolutely encourage you to follow up Representative Grassl. He's been a very engaging, open-door legislator, and so I think there's a lot of sincerity in that offer. Is that it? All right. Very well, then. Thank you both for being here today, for your work, and for your testimony this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Mariano.
And with that, members, I'm going to ask our Vice Chair, Representative Edelson, to occupy this chair just for a little bit. I want it back as I go forward and present the next bill.
Chair Mariani, would you like to move 739 before the committee?
Madam Chair, I would. I would move that House File 739 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, I have to admit, this is a view I haven't seen yet before. So it's pretty impressive. It's also a little bit intimidating. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, and then also the DE-1 amendment, would you also like to move that?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would so move.
Chair Mariani, go ahead.
This is the DE-1 amendment.
Oh, okay, sorry. Everyone in the audience, please bear with me. But we would like to move to have the DE-1 amendment adopted. All those in favor?
Madam Chair, and this will put the bill in the shape that the author proposals to have before us.
Great. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Go ahead, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm introducing this bill in order to offer hope to those individuals who face a terrible and unjust consequence of a criminal conviction that frankly should never have been entered in the first place. Post-conviction relief exists in Minnesota precisely as a remedy in our criminal justice system for over 50 years to play an important role in making sure that unlawful and unconstitutional criminal convictions can be remedied even after the trial process is over. But this remedy is too often out of reach for those who need it most. Right now, if someone has a defective criminal conviction, they're limited to filing a post-conviction petition within 2 years. Exceptions exist for this two-year period. And it is time we recognize that one of those exceptions should apply to those who suddenly find themselves in danger of deportation. Deportation as a result of a defective criminal conviction. So this afternoon, you're going to hear testimony from impacted family members and people who were faced with exile from their only country that they have ever known, our country, and the possibility that they will be forced to not only be separated from their loved ones, but having to live in a country they had never been in. Members, it does happen. I've known individuals over the years where that situation has occurred. And in keeping with our theme of community-centered public safety, such circumstances, in fact, break communities in Minnesota. So today you will hear testimony from people who can explain how the process of deportation for crimes can include deporting people who have lived here their whole lives and whose crimes can be years or even decades old. Today, we will have multiple testifiers. It's my privilege to have with us today my mayor of St. Paul, Mayor Melvin Carter. Also, Linus Chan, who is a professor and immigration attorney at the University of Minnesota Center for New Americans, and the attorney on a case you're going to hear about in a few minutes, Jenny Stray's husband's case. And then Jenny herself, who's a founder of Release Minnesota 8, and obviously an impacted family member. So members, with that, and Madam Chair, I'd ask my testifiers to come forward.
Very good. Welcome, Mayor Carter.
Thank you very much.
Could you please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon to you. My name is Melvin Carter, and I serve as mayor of the city of St. Paul. I'm honored to be here today and greatly appreciate your leadership. The fact that a public safety and criminal justice reform division even exists says much about the Minnesota House of Representatives and of each legislator around this table. Specifically, I want to thank Chief Bill Author, Representative Carlos Mariani, as well as co-authors Representative Kelly Herr, Representative Rod Hamilton, Representative Fu Lee, Representative Samantha Vang, and Representative Mohammed Noor. Thank you very much for your leadership. I'm honored to have the opportunity to testify before this committee and to support House File 739, a bill to ensure that our criminal justice system works for all of us. The Center for American Progress recently reported that 1 in 3 Americans have some type of criminal record due to decades of overcriminalization and mass incarceration in our country. They found that individuals with a criminal record, no matter how minor, will encounter lifelong obstacles to nearly every pillar of social and economic stability and success. This includes employment, housing, education, and immigration. For immigrants and refugees, the consequences of having a criminal record, even one that is 20 years old, and even for individuals who have rehabilitated their lives and lived as contributing community members, can quickly become a life sentence to a foreign country, a place they've never known, a place where they do not understand the language or cultural way of life. We see images on the news and hear stories of families being torn apart, communities living in fear, and local and state governments are called to respond to our communities in crisis. That's why I'm here today. Release Minnesota 8 and the many important immigration advocates and criminal justice reform supporters to bring attention and urgency to this community crisis in our city, our state, and our country. This past Christmas, as we were all celebrating, around 40 Cambodian American community members were torn away from their families and deported to Cambodia. Since 2017, ICE has conducted mass raids across the country in the Cambodian American community and deported a staggering 110 Cambodian community members in fiscal year 2018. These mass raids are not only happening in the Southeast Asian community. New Americans from Liberia, Somalia, Mexico, and other countries are experiencing the same type of targeting. These new Americans came to our country to start a new life and to escape political and religious persecution. After decades of making our country their homeland, we are now re-traumatizing entire communities. This is both unconscionable and un-American. Our nation has a proud tradition of welcoming immigrants and refugees into our communities, and Minnesota has led the way. Minnesota's first large group of immigrants came from European countries of Norway, Sweden, Ireland, and Germany. Today, Minnesota's immigrant and refugee populations are from across the globe, including Central and South America, Southeast and South Asia, East and West Africa. In St. Paul, 20% of our residents are foreign-born, 30% speak more than one language, and in our St. Paul public schools, our students speak over 100 different languages. That's an opportunity for us economically, culturally, and socially. Our city's population growth in recent years has been driven particularly by people of color, who now make up about 46% of our population. A 2018 report by the New American Economy found that immigrants and refugees play an important role in St. Paul's economy. As the drivers of population growth, they make up a significant percentage of our labor force, entrepreneurs, and state and local tax contributors. As the mayor of our capital city and global community, It is my duty to ensure that everyone in our city has access to justice, regardless of their national origin or birthplace. To ensure that all of us have the opportunity to feel safe, secure, and welcome, and to protect and support the drivers of economic growth. Last year, St. Paul partnered with Ramsey County to together invest $200,000 to start an immigrant defense fund, and we in St. Paul have also invested funding for a full-time position to support the safety and economic success of immigrants and refugees in our city. I'm here today because I can't do this work alone. The state has a critical role to play, and I'm partnering with Chair Mariani to ensure that new Americans in St. Paul and across our state have access to justice. We're living in an era of unprecedented attacks on our immigrant and refugee families, and we cannot remain silent. We are a nation of immigrants, a nation that values family and community. So let's work together to find solutions that ensure justice, access to justice for all. I would like to share, just call to your attention, you have in front of you a list of the coalition partners that support Release Minnesota 8. And I would also like to let you know that Ramsey County Attorney John Choi has also written a letter supporting a pathway for relief for people facing deportation as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Chair, your next testifier.
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Lightus. Linus Chan.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Linus Chan. Thank you very much, committee members, as well as chair, for allowing me to speak. I'm only a recent, quote-unquote, immigrant to Minnesota, coming from far away as Illinois. So I take this as a singular pleasure in being able to address this committee on this bill and what its effects are. So to be clear, I'm here as the attorney for Ched Nin, who is Jenny's husband. I'm here as someone who has been working closely with the coalition and groups of people that have been trying to figure out what they can do about this particular issue. I am not here on behalf of the University of Minnesota. So let me give a little context about the work that I do and why it is that I believe that I was asked to testify in front of you. One, I'm an immigration attorney. I'm not only an immigration attorney, but I'm an immigration attorney for those who are facing removal. Not only am I an immigration attorney for those facing removal, but I'm an immigration attorney for those facing removal who usually have a criminal history. And not only for those who have criminal history, but those who are detained. And the question then that becomes before us is, are we deporting the right people? Are the people that are in these jails the ones that should be deported? It's obvious, right, when we talk about these issues, when we use the word criminal, and that's one of the aspects of these decriminalizing communities, what do we mean by criminal? That word has been used, of course, to describe dangerous people, people we don't want in the United States. Unfortunately, that usage of the word is becoming increasingly inaccurate. Simply because you have gone through the criminal justice system does not make you dangerous. It also doesn't necessarily make you guilty. And one of the issues this bill addresses is the question of people whose crimes that were originally entered illegally or were originally suspect at the time that they were entered, should they not have a chance to go in front of a judge and ask that judge to revisit whether or not that crime was in fact lawful, constitutional, and properly entered against them. It is important when looking at the context of this bill, one could be deceived into thinking that the language that we've included, the B6 clause, somehow gives a quote-unquote substantive right to get their crime vacated. It does not. The statute we are talking about, the time limitation statute on the post-conviction bill, only controls the question of who can bring a post-conviction petition at all. It does not address who can win a post-conviction petition. People who can win a post-conviction petition still need to show that the original conviction, whether it be 20 years ago, 10 years ago, or 3 years ago, they need to show that their conviction was legally and constitutionally suspect. If they can't, this This bill doesn't do anything for them. The problem, of course, is from what I have seen, there are instances where people have had old convictions that are legally and constitutionally suspect. They could have been all sorts of reasons, from bad advice of counsel to not properly investigating whether or not there was another form of inquiry to prove someone's innocence. And of course, now one of the things that's been very close to what's happening right here is the crime labs. What we know, for instance, the St. Paul crime lab is undergoing a scandal, whether or not there was bad, tainted evidence. These are all things that can happen at the time of conviction, but that there is an enormous pressure for people to take a plea, to go forward, to live their lives. The 2-year limitation on the post-conviction statute is a new creature. It's important to understand that. It's only been in place for less than 15 years. It was passed in 2005. From the 1960s, from I believe 61 until 2005, there was no limitation. Other states don't have a limitation on the post-conviction relief. What this bill does is only create one exception to the 2-year limitation. And that exception is especially applicable because it addresses the people who might not have any incentive to challenge their convictions until well after 2 years. So let me just paint a quick picture for you. And it's important because these crimes do not have to be the ones that you think of. They don't have to be rape, murder. They are not the serious crimes. They could be something as simple as a possession of a controlled substance. Imagine that you are a non-citizen and you are being placed into criminal proceedings for possession of a controlled substance. You think, you told your lawyer tells you, you know what, we could fight the case, but I also got a good deal on your case, and you know, you can be finished with your crime, be in and out, maybe not even serve more than 90 days in any sort of criminal setting. You rely on that advice, you say, okay, good, I'll do that. And maybe this conviction happened 20 years ago. So you do that 20 years ago, you're a non-citizen, you have a green card, you've lived your life, and that's exactly what happens. You get out, you live your life. Maybe there was something worrying about the conviction itself, but you're out, you're with your family. Why would you fight that now? Why would you risk that now? Well, what I've seen, and I know exactly the situation, where ICE doesn't come a-calling till 20 years later. At 20 years later is when you suddenly find out that everything you've built, your life that you've had in the United States for 40 years, has been suspect and put into danger. And why? Because of a crime that was originally suspect to begin with. But you had no incentive to appeal. You had no incentive to bring a post-conviction relief, primarily because you got to live your life until you can't. This bill would simply allow someone to make the claim that their crime that they originally were convicted of, that crime should not have been entered in the first place. It's also important, I think, to understand, second, why are we here in terms of post-conviction relief? Why is this the forum that we are asking for help on from the state legislature? And the simple answer is the federal government does not respect the state's definition of what constitutes a crime. So, a quick example is, it does not matter that the Minnesota legislature has deemed petty misdemeanors to not be crimes. It doesn't matter that in the Minnesota courts, one could get a sentence suspended, or what's called a stay of adjudication, which would not normally be what's considered a conviction in Minnesota state court system. The federal system does not care. And more importantly and more relevant to this statute, the federal system does not care if you try to vacate a criminal sentence based on rehabilitation or immigration hardships. That's the rule in what's called matter of Pickering. What that basically says is, assume for a second that I am an immigrant. Assume for a second that I got convicted of a crime, but there was nothing wrong with that crime. The conviction was solid. It was what should have happened at that time. I built a life for myself, but now I'm in trouble. I'm about to be deported. I go to the Minnesota courts and say, please, I don't want to be deported. I don't want to be deported. I built my life. Can you please help me? And let's assume that the judge is merciful and decides, you know what? I will grant you post-conviction relief. If that judge does so and explains it, the basis for that post-conviction is to prevent deportation, ICE will deport me anyway. Why is that important? It's important because there are limited tools that this legislature has to protect their own citizens from deportation, especially those with criminal convictions. This is the way to do it. This does not allow people to create new ways to attack their old criminal conviction. They still must be able to claim that something else was wrong with their crime. This is not going to be floodgates. I pulled out some numbers in terms of post-conviction relief, and I just want to make sure this committee understands. In 2017, which is the only date that the Minnesota Judicial Branch keeps those statistics, a total of 244 post-conviction petitions were filed. Out of that, only 63 were granted. Out of the ones in which were filed after the two-year limitation, only 137 were filed. Only 26 in the entire state of Minnesota were granted. This is not going to lead to a whole slew of more cases. Again, even just facing deportation is not enough. I have to be facing deportation, and my original criminal conviction has to be legally suspect or unconstitutional. Otherwise, it doesn't get me through the door. So with that in mind, I just want to be clear, Jenny is going to be able to chance to tell you exactly what happened more in her case. But these are cases that I'm hearing about. These are people that are coming forward. They are afraid. They are desperate. And yes, many of them have cases in which there's at least an argument that the original criminal conviction was suspect. And the question that I think that should be asked by this committee is whether how long and what effect should we have an unjust, unconstitutional, illegal conviction, what effect do we want those convictions to have on people and their lives? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. Thank you for clarifying the law and what this bill would do. Chair Mariani, do you want to move to your next testifier?
Please, Madam Chair, I call on my next testifier.
Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Jenny Stray. I am an impacted family member and a founding member of Release Minnesota 8, an organization with a mission to provide direct support to Southeast Asian families impacted by detention and deportation through leadership development, community organizing, to bring about social and political change. I'm here to share my story and express support for House File 739. To start, I'd like to give a brief background. My father came to the U.S. in 1976 as a refugee from Cambodia. He fled war and genocide that killed nearly 2 million of the Cambodian population. He was a part of a mass refugee resettlement that stemmed from 1975 to 1985. At that time, this country recognized the damage of what a U.S.-inflicted war had done to Southeast Asian countries, and welcomed almost 800,000 refugees from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, of which 100,000 have chosen Minnesota to be their home. My husband, Ched Nin, was among that number. He was born in a refugee camp in Thailand, arriving in the U.S. at the age of 6. His family struggled to adjust to a new system while also still trying to grieve the loss of half their family members and 4 of his older siblings. After over 20 years of living in the U.S., he made a mistake that cost him a sentence of 2 years. Then suddenly, out of nowhere, in August of 2016, he, along with 7 other families, were put into deportation proceedings. Thus, the campaign Release Minnesota 8 was born. We tried every route to save our families. My husband's plea in criminal court was constitutionally invalid, and he qualified for post-conviction relief. However, his request was denied for being time-barred and past the two-year time limit. We did not understand that his plea was invalid until years later. While the judge was sympathetic, he could not waive the two-year time limit. Throughout our campaign, we were faced with many of these no's. We were being told that we were not worth the bold political moves needed to protect our families. We could not accept these answers. And with our determination and perseverance, we've been able to achieve the unthinkable and impossible, as we were able to get three of the Minnesota 8 released back to their families. We gained national attention for our resiliency to keep our families together, and were featured in news outlets like The New Yorker and a 30-minute segment on Al Jazeera. Today, we appreciate bill authors and Mayor Carter, who stand with us and did not say no. Release Minnesota 8 is a group of family members who have never organized or testified at a legislative hearing. But we believe it is wrong to criminalize our families and our community members with these life sentences of deportation and to be torn away from our family. We are pushed to continue to do this work for our family and to be a resource for the Southeast Asian community who are impacted by these harsh policies. We created a toolkit with national partners and the law school to discuss the organizing and legal strategies that were necessary to fight for our families. I have copies of that along with a report highlighting our stories about the impact of detention and deportation on women and girls. Our families will continue to fight for legal pathways for our families to be together, and we want to work to increase justice for all. Thank you.
Madam Chair, concludes our testimony. I also want to point out that there should be a letter that was distributed at the beginning of the hearing from our Attorney General, State Attorney General, expressing his support for this legislation. And with that, Madam Chair, we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Mariani, can you help me understand the last sentence of the bill? I've gone over it and over it, and I'm not exactly sure, sure how we get to the point of what actual knowledge is. And maybe you could just, sure, on the record, just sort of put that out. So if this does go to court, they have a bar by which they can understand what that measure is.
Sure, Mariani. I think I can answer that question. So the Minnesota Supreme Court, in two decisions, Juan Sanchez versus State and Carlton versus State, read the language of the bill without that clause at all and imposed what's called a should-have-known standard. And they have since interpreted that should-have-known standard in what's called an objective way. I think the problem, of course, is an should-have-known objective standard. If it's not, it's very problematic because it requires the existence or looking at the possible judgment of someone that doesn't actually exist, right? So what does it mean that someone should have known that the plea was invalid? Right. What does it mean that someone should have known that something that gave rise to a reason why their plea was unconstitutional or valid? So this standard actually is attempting to make it clear that what the standard that should be used is, when did the person actually know that they had a claim arise? And that should be when the two-year toll begins, right? If you know, where this bill obviously does not allow people to sit on their claims, but it does require something rather than trying to be judged, having a judge later on trying to judge what a person should have known, what kind of person was, what that objective aspect of a should have known standard is. So that's the attempt.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's helpful. So can you just give like an example of something that could be presented as evidence in a court of law that would show that they know?
Sure. Well, I think one instructive example was with Mr. Nin's case itself, right? At the time, the question was, when he was first convicted and then he was first placed into removal proceedings, that is when the criminal court judge said, oh, he should have known that there was a problem. Of course, at the same time, Mr. Nin was being told by his own embassy, right, the Cambodian embassy had said, we're not going to take you back. The judge in his case said, oh, we're not going to take you back. There are other people who said, we're not going to take you back. And you've been checking in all this time. And the evidence on the should have known is when he gets the letter that says, come in now, we are going to deport you. That would be actual knowledge that he knows. Now, obviously, I admit that that is one interpretation, but I think it's instructive to see that the question isn't should he or should he not have. The question is when did he actually know that this claim can arise, right?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Jenny for telling her story and coming forward. The Minnesota 8 have been incredibly brave through this process and raising up the issues of long ago criminal activity, criminal cases that had, you know, where the families have established themselves in the U.S. for decades often past these cases. And I just wondered if you could elaborate a little bit. How old was your husband when the incident that he got in trouble for happened, and how long ago was this?
It was in 2010, and he was in his mid-20s.
And what was your husband doing when he received the order for deportation? Yeah.
He had a criminal conviction of a second-degree assault. He had a BB gun, which he... he was doing his job. Oh, sorry. Thank you for clarifying. So he... he shot a BB gun at a car, and so that's considered the second degree. So, So before that, we got married. He works as a carpenter for the Carpenters Union, Local 322. We have 6 kids. We just recently had our baby, so he's 6 months old. And he's a great father, very, very great father. He's a hard worker, and he's been a carpenter for 20 years. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing your story today.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yes, thank you for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it. And also, I had some concerns when I saw this because I handle appellate work and folks in my office handle post-conviction work, and so I want to thank the those who have been working on this bill that did come and meet with me, and you addressed some of my concerns, but I still did have a couple of questions, and one of those really has to do with what Representative O'Neill asked about, too. Mr. Chen, in the example that you gave for that has actual knowledge makes sense to me when we're talking about the B6. But I am a little worried that where it's at in subdivision C is going to apply to all post-conviction claims, and that will be very difficult to prove when someone has actual knowledge. And so I'll ask you to address that. And I'll also just say, too, in response to what you talked about, the number of post-conviction petitions brought and granted, you know, post-conviction typically happens after the appeal, direct appeal process. So many more people go through the direct appeal process, and then whether or not they have a direct appeal, they may decide then to go on to a post-conviction case. So that can kind of explain some of those numbers. But if you just wanted to please address to me why you think C is the right place for that,
sure.
And how that wouldn't be too broad in applying to many different kinds of claims.
Mr. Chen.
Sure. First of all, I confess I am not a criminal appellate defender. So I do note that there are a couple of them here, including Ms. Catherine Middlebrook. So if I screw up, I hopefully won't. But I will check in to make sure. So one of the biggest things I think is important to understand on post-conviction is that the burden is on the petitioner, generally. So while I think there is the idea, well, you know, how do we prove the actual knowledge standard, that still requires the petitioner to make that proof. And if that proof is insufficient, then that's going to be what the judge is going to decide. So I understand that there might be a concern, you know, here as we talk, what that standard might look like. I just think it's more problematic the way it is currently interpreted by the Supreme Court that just requires a should-have-known objective standard. I think if it was a should-have-known subjective standard, that might be somewhat better, though how do we know a judge can actually make a subjective determination on someone? But I think the combination of a should-have-known standard with a subjective standard, I think places that a little bit too far out of reach. So that's my only response to you on that. The second response, I do want to make one note. I do think it's true that there are, of course, criminal appeals that people do avail themselves. But many people plead, and they don't. When they plead, they don't get a chance to appeal. So post-conviction is the only time in which there's a plea, that the plea might be subject to problems. Well, you're shaking your head, so I apologize. Did I misstate it? I apologize.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, right there. I know I'm in hot water, so apparently I apologize.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, people can still appeal from a direct. From a plea.
Okay.
That does happen. I guess one other, and I know you're willing to work on language, and I guess one other issue I'll bring up, and this is really in the weeds here, but Ms. Middlebrook will understand what I'm talking about. When we're talking about the case NAFLA and how this impacts the NAFLA decision and cases that are on direct appeal, maybe somebody did direct appeal and then presents post-conviction, what happens in those situations. So we don't necessarily have to address that now. I just hope you'll have some willingness to work perhaps on some better language, because I think that what you're trying to do here is really good, and I'm supportive of that. I just want to make sure that it's not too broad.
Sure. I don't feel qualified. I feel very unqualified to answer the NAFLA question. I've only a little bit of awareness of that case.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess maybe for the author, if you can answer this question, or if somebody else wants to jump in. I guess looking at it, you have the 2-year time frame, but the new language, I guess, is there a time limit on that portion of it? Or do you have a certain amount of time that you allow them to take care of business?
Chair Mariani?
So it's 2 years on both. So the normal limit on the post-conviction is 2 years. And then subclause C, which you'll see, is another 2-year limitation on bringing the exception. So let's assume that there is a conviction that's more than 2 years old that you want to challenge on post-conviction. You're limited on bringing on that exception to 2 years, generally. I think there might be an exception under subclause 3, but I'm not completely, because that is a really old conviction. But the general idea is it is generally 2 years on both. So 2 years to bring a post-conviction relief petition, and then 2 years again to bring an exception to the post-relief. And this is the debate right now on the should-have-known or actual-known standard. But when you know about that exception, you can't sit on it. You need to bring it up within those 2 years.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Grossel.
Is that something that you'd want to make crystal clear in this?
I hope it is. If there is a way, we'll obviously, if it needs to be clarified, we're more than happy to help clarify that language. It's just a weird statute in the sense that it's the whole statutory is about time limits. So that's why there's like multiple time limits within time limits.
All right, members, there's 2 more people on the list. I'm going to ask you to keep your comments brief because we have another bill. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm really grateful that this is being brought forward as well. I'm thinking about some of the discussion we've had about the impact on children when their parents are incarcerated, and some of the work that I've been focused on early childhood, and just when the mention was of your family having 6 kids and the impact on having their dad out of their lives and out of the country, just thinking about the impact of that, and of course amplified in so many families as well. I'm grateful to have our city, Mr. Mayor, leading on this, because St. Paul has been a city of immigrants for all of its history, from all kinds of different places around the country and around the world. And so I'm really glad, of course, that's caused us to have a great vibrancy in our city. It's been wonderful. I will admit to having some concerns as well just about the language. I think I don't practice in this area, unlike Representative Moeller, so my brain is just moving a lot more slowly. And I spoke with Professor Chan really briefly yesterday. So I think I probably want to follow up with you. And I saw Michelle Garnett McKenzie from the Advocates for Human Rights I've worked a lot with as well. I do just have one question maybe for now on that, though. And reading the court paperwork that you provided, it looked to me like Mr. Nin actually was placed into immigration removal proceedings kind of right away, soon after being released, so soon after the conviction. And so as I read the bill, it seems like it would then, if I'm reading that right, then the 2 years would apply soon after, right after that. So I feel like maybe I'm misreading that, but if you can just clarify that point for me.
Sure. I think the first removal proceeding that missed, so first of all, let me be clear, there are people who do not get put immediately into removal proceedings, right? So it's a very good question, Representative Pinnell. In Mr. Nin's case, the argument would be simply this. At the time he was placed in the removal proceedings, three different entities were telling him he didn't have to worry about removal. The judge on this case, the actual immigration judge, told him, don't worry, you're not going to be removed. His own embassy told him, you're not going to be removed. And everybody around in the immigration system says, we're not deporting anyone to Cambodia. You're not going to be removed. So in that sense, it's the claim would be the later part when he gets put back into detention and be told, you know what? Forget what everyone was saying to you in 2010, you are going to be removed. We are processing you for removal now. So that is a shift in the administrative policy. I think it is somewhat specific to these facts, specifically because he was told at the time, you're not going to get deported to Cambodia. Don't worry, no one is. And I want to emphasize this also applies to Somalia. Somalians for a long time were being told they're never going to get deported, and then they were, and then never, and then were, and then never. The seesawing back that happens on that can play havoc with people's lives. So I just wanted to address that. But that's exactly what happened in this case, is that Mr. Nguyen was told on multiple occasions at the time he was first put in proceedings, don't worry, you're not going to get deported to Cambodia.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so really quickly, so it sounds like you're saying that although that first clause in the new Section 6 applied, that he was placed in immigration removal proceedings, some of the other ones had not yet kicked in. For example, that removal was more likely than not. And so at that point, because it's an or, he could rely on the other clause,
that's,
essentially. So
that's
any of those clauses kicking in.
That's exactly right. That's the intent.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand you to say that your husband's initial charge was he shot a BB gun at a car?
Yeah, he shot it. Yes, he did.
2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, there are literally thousands of kids in greater Minnesota that are in danger of 2-year sentences then.
Is there anyone from the public that has any testimony they would like to? Chair, do you have any closing statements on this bill?
Madam Chair, first of all, I want to thank the committee members for the rigorous and intentionally deliberate questions to understand the proposal before us. It's a bit unusual for this committee, I believe. And in the spirit of not only making sense of it, but crafting good legislation. It is my hope that that is consistently at the core of this committee, certainly at the core of this legislation. There's been a lot of efforts put into this. Thank you, Representative Moeller, for reaching out to help us continue to shape this. It is my intent to lay this over so that we can continue that process. And so when we next see it, it'll be even better. But the justice issue remains important, not only to my city of St. Paul, a city truly of immigrants, but frankly, all across our state. And so my hope is that we'll be able to act on this positively in the coming weeks. So with that, Madam Chair, I would renew my motion to, or I would renew the, this is odd. I would ask that the chair lay the bill on the table for possible inclusion of the omnibus bill.
Thank you. I thank you all for your testimony. This bill will, with that, the chair will lay this bill over. Thank you.
Let me ask, Madam Chair, I wonder if perhaps we could have the page distribute the material that Ms. Strabe brought.
Yeah,
I think so, to help distribute those.
Thank you. Decriminalization of communities.
Chair Mariani. Members. Members. Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, I would move that House File 571 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Okay. I'm like totally solo here.
Madam Chair, you would just simply repeat what I said.
I can't hear what you said. It's alone.
I have a soft voice, don't I?
All right, so we are going to
571
for any amendments. No amendments. All right, the 571 will be moved to the General Register.
Madam Chair, this is a simple bill. It basically, there is no substantive change in law here. It basically makes our existing statute clear. As opposed to the incredible verbiage in existing statute, it just structures it so it's much more clear about the accepted statutes in terms of amending the certification of certain misdemeanors. And I would certainly, if there are questions, I would certainly defer our legal counsel to explain the technical nature of this bill.
And then Johnson. Yes. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, or Chair Mariani, I was just wondering why the need for this clarification.
Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it's always a good idea for us to be clear in state statute, and so that's my intent here.
Representative Johnson. Okay. With that, does the public have any testimony? All right. All right, so I renew the motion to refer this House File 571 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Motion passes.
All right, so then that's it. Representative Lesh.
Okay, I'm giving it back.
Well, just don't give up the gavel.
You're seated. You've got it ready.
Trying to get a break here. Representative Lesh, I believe you have a motion before us.
Yes. What is the motion, Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesh, your motion is that your bill, and I'll get the number of it in a second here,
Mr. Chair.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And that's my motion, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Lesh so moves.
Thank you. And if I could just, I won't go into too many details because this was covered multiple times. We went over this and had outstanding testifiers of folks who had been in prison, and we found out later shouldn't have been. And so there was a very bipartisan and I think unanimous effort to ensure that they received compensation for that time that they shouldn't spend in prison. But we subsequently had a court decision that found fault with a particular section of the statute that we passed that raised my eyebrows, but I'm not one to call that because we have the power to change it. So that's what we did last year. Another, I think, a bipartisan accepted method of how we got the language fixed, but then it died in the omnibus prime. So we're back here again this year to try again, as we are with many other bills. And I have with me Julie Jonas from the Innocence Project that can detail the bill.
Very well. Ms. Jonas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lesh, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Julie Jonas. I'm the legal director at the Innocence Project of Minnesota. As Representative Lesh stated, this was a bill that went the bill that you have before you is making some changes to a bill that passed nearly unanimously in the House in 2014. There were two no votes, and unanimously in the Senate, and was signed into law to benefit people who had been wrongfully convicted, people who spent time incarcerated within our criminal justice system for crimes that they didn't commit. I think everybody can acknowledge that we can never give them back that time, but this was some small way.
Not now.
Okay.
You're done. I just want to get in there, though.
Please continue, Ms. Jonas.
Thank you. That this is some small way to give them back the time that they lost, and that this monetary compensation is an acknowledgement of the harm done. Since the time of the passage of the bill in 2014, only six people have received compensation under this bill. Three were known about at the time of the bill passage, and their exonerations had occurred many years prior. Since the bill passed, only three new exonerations have occurred, allowing people to obtain compensation under this bill. And the amounts that they received from the legislature were relatively small, the largest being $131,000, the other two being substantially smaller than that. I raise this to say that this is not a floodgates issue. There are not many people who will qualify under this bill, regardless of the changes that are being proposed. And there are some changes that I am bringing forward, again, that passed last year but were included in the omnibus bill that was vetoed by the governor. The changes that we're discussing today, several of the smaller ones, came to us from various practitioners in the justice system who suggested as they started to work with the bill that we were missing certain issues. So I want to address those. But I also want to address what happened when the Supreme Court invalidated a section of this statute in the case State v. Back. In that case, Ms. Back was convicted of second-degree manslaughter for the murder of one former boyfriend at the hands of a different former boyfriend. The prosecution was based on culpable negligence that Ms. Back had a duty to protect one former boyfriend from the other former boyfriend. The Supreme Court reversed her conviction, saying that she had no duty to protect the former boyfriend. Once her conviction was overturned, there were no remaining charges left against her. She had spent 2 years in prison between the time of conviction and the time that her appeal was successful, and so she sought compensation under MIRA. In seeking compensation, two issues were litigated. One was the issue of, was her release consistent, were the grounds under which she was released, were they consistent with innocence? And did MIRA violate equal protection, because under the specific circumstances of her case and the statute, a whole category of people would be eliminated from receiving compensation because the prosecutor was being asked to do an impossible act if there were no charges left. What the Minnesota Supreme Court decided to do was to sever all of Section 590.11, Subdivision 1(1)(i), which eliminated an even greater class of petitioners. Now, exonerees who prosecutors decide not to retry after a conviction is vacated or reversed cannot apply for compensation under the current law. The people who came to testify before you, the innocent exonerees who this committee heard from in 2014, would in fact not be eligible for compensation under the law as it currently exists because this important piece was severed. As Justice Lilyhaug noted in his dissent in the Back case, their court was acting with a cleaver rather than a scalpel in exercising in this piece. Whether Ms. Back's conviction was overturned because she was actually innocent is a good question for the district courts to answer and a fair question. The second argument, though, however, requiring an impossible act by the prosecutor was an outcome never intended by the authors of this bill. The new language in Section 59011 will remedy that problem and make the remaining portions of the subdivision consistent with the needed changes. In addition, in working with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association last year, we were able to draft language to further define what consistent with innocence means to give more guidance to the court regarding that threshold issue. Those changes are consistent with existing Minnesota case law. The remaining changes are the changes that were suggested to us by various criminal practitioners within the state. The first one in Section 1 is there to reflect the fact that a case could be overturned based on innocence by a court other than Minnesota, namely a federal court or the United States Supreme Court. So that's the reason for that change. Section 3 addresses a petitioner who is actually innocent of the crime for which they were convicted, but was also serving time on probation at the time of that conviction for another different offense. They could have been very successful on probation, doing everything that their probation officer required, but that probationary sentence, for which they were guilty, is violated because they have a new criminal conviction for which they're not guilty. So this allows someone, if they have those two convictions that they're serving time for simultaneously, and the only reason for the second probationary sentence to have been executed was because of the new conviction for which they're innocent, they should receive compensation for that portion of the sentence. Sections 3, 4, 5, 6, and 8 all have included the word incarceration, rather so that we will compensate people for time served in custody other than just prison. Because as we know, especially with probationary sentences, many people convicted of felonies can serve a significant amount of time in local county jails, oftentimes because they committed no new crime, but rather because they violated probation by failing to check in with their probation officer, by failing to get their GED, by failing to maintain full-time work, by drinking when they were on probation. All are things that we don't want people to do, but if they're actually innocent of the underlying conviction and they're spending 60 days in jail, 90 days in jail, 120 days in jail, because of these violations that are not illegal, they should be compensated for that time. Section 5 is just the inclusion of the word additional. That was left out of the statute but was in many of the early versions. It allows for economic damages that are unique to the individual that should be considered above the $50,000 base rate per year, but would still keep the maximum amount of compensation under $100,000 per year. And then finally in Section 6, we want to allow a petitioner who is successful in getting their order allowing for compensation and getting a damages award to bring that whenever the legislature is in session. So in other words, if they get it early in the current legislative session, they shouldn't have to wait till the following year to bring that before the legislature. So those are the changes that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jonas. Are there questions? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Lesh, for bringing this forward. Actually, my question is not about the bill. Does exoneration automatically come with compensation?
No, it doesn't. It has to. You have to follow the many steps of MIRA in order for a petitioner to get that.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question.
Representative Considine.
Can exoneration be done posthumously?
Ms. Jonas.
That is a good question. If it wasn't so far, the Supreme Court has not allowed it, but I think there is an open question as to whether the Pardon Board could.
Representative Consular.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that President Clinton pardoned a West Point graduate that was roughly 100 years ago, so I think there's a precedent as far as pardoning. But exoneration, that's an open question.
We have brought one case to the Minnesota Supreme Court where our client, who we believe was innocent and it was proven through DNA testing, died while the case was still in litigation. We brought that to the Supreme Court and they denied our request for relief based on a technicality in the filing.
Chair Consonant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to chat with you real briefly after the hearing.
Thank you.
Chair Lesh, I'm wondering if perhaps we could have the county attorneys come forward. My understanding is they were supportive in the last year of this bill, and I guess just for the record, I'd like to see where their position is this year.
Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Small as well.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director with the County Attorneys Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Lesh, who has had a very open door. When this bill was first introduced, we had not had the opportunity to talk with both the Innocence Project and the Minnesota Association of Defense Lawyers. And Representative Lesh was very open to holding on to that bill until we had the opportunity to meet and talk through some of the concerns that we had. The Innocence Project and the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association and the County Attorneys Association sat down, worked through this language. Everything worked pretty well. We then got that information back to Representative Lesh, who was kind enough to incorporate our modified language into the bill, and that's the current bill before you today, and the County Attorneys Association fully supports that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Small. Thank you for your work on this. Chair Lesh, it sounds like a good process in terms of making sure we have good legislation before us. Thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Chair Mariani, it's more of a comment. First of all, I want to thank Representative Lesh for bringing this forward again this year. It was unfortunate it got vetoed last year, but the good thing is we got a few other things corrected as well, and I want to thank you for the work with all the groups to get this done properly.
Very well. Any other questions? Does anyone else wish to testify on the bill? Okay, very well. Representative Leslie, the chair. Oh, bless you. The chair then, I'm sorry. The chair then will lay House File 707 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Members, we're done early. I don't know what to do with all this time. Other than to reinforce to you all that a couple of things. One, watch out for the snow outside. And two, thank you for this week's focus on community center public safety. Next week, we'll have good conversations, mostly focused on probation, again, keeping with our theme of community center public safety. Members, please do drive carefully and have a wonderful weekend. This committee stands adjourned.